Donald Reel Number 7. Now, could you also describe for me the reverse procedure of getting the seaplanes back aboard?
Yes. It was exactly reverse, but it was a bit more tricky. You had to taxi the plane right up to the ship's side. That's on the quarter. The quarter being the... it's the side of the aft deck, not the under the stern itself. If you came up under the stern, you'd get crushed. You come up on the quarter, just where you left, but you've got to judge it pretty neatly because you have to taxi up as close to the ship side as you can and stop your engine because your propeller will slice something to bits if it gets foul of anything, and your observer had to leap up rapidly onto the top plane and grab that swinging hook from the crane. And if you missed the hook, it was just too bad, because you drifted away very rapidly with your engine stopped, and then you'd get your engine restarted again, which wasn't always just all that easy. However, assuming he grabbed the hook all right, got it hooked into the sling on top of the top plane, then the chaps on the crane had to know their stuff. They had to take in the slack very quickly and lift her, just as you rose on a wave, take in the slack quickly, hold it tight so that when the wave dropped away and left you hanging, then they got you hoisting. And as soon as you were really clear of the water, then of course it was quite easy. She came up reasonably, started swinging a bit. Chaps on the deck are standing there with long bamboo poles with padded ends to make sure the wingtips didn't foul the shed or any other projections. And the chaps with the poles would steer her around as the crane lifted her and swung her inboard and dropped her onto a trolley. And normally it could be done pretty quickly, but it was a bit more tricky than getting her into the water, especially if it was a bit of a sea had got up in the meantime.
And once you got her up to deck level, what happened to her then?
Well, fold the wings, trundle her into the shed, and back we were.
I believe about this time there were some wireless sets installed on the seaplanes you were operating with. Could you describe for me the kind of experiments you were doing with this and how that changed your flying operations?
Well, they extended the range very greatly because we no longer needed to rely on a red Verries light to signal the presence of a submarine or anything of that sort. I mean, you could fly 100-odd miles out into the North Sea and still get your messages through eventually, but we'd keep on trying further flights and various improvements to the sets. The sets themselves were very large things made by the RNAS. I'm not just sure which, probably at Eastchurch.
How large were they?
Well, it's difficult to describe. I say they were about the size of a large, easy chair. I know they took up most of the unfortunate observer's cockpit. He didn't have much room left. And all I can remember is a colossal rotary spark gap with blue flames. Every time he pressed the Morse key, you got this rotary blue flame, which was within about 6 inches of your petrol tank. It gave a marvellous effect. And nobody ever actually caught fire, but it could have happened any moment, I'm sure. But the fact remains, they gradually got increased the range, and wasn't a question of experimenting or operational. We just had to use them operationally and keep on improving the function. That's really how you experimented. It was combined operational and experimental.
What kind of aerial did these wireless sets use?
Oh, the observer lowered in a big coil of finely stranded copper wire with a lead weight on the end of it. I forget how long it was, but I know it was a dash long wire. It trailed well down below and sloping out at an angle of about 45 degrees, I should think. I should think it was lowered down for about 60 or 80, perhaps. About 80 feet, I think. It might have been more, I'm not sure. And then he would wind it in by hand on the drum after he'd finished his sending. But Keeping in mind, this was not wireless telephony, it was telegraphy. It was Morse code. It was easier to get through than a voice thing. So that we really built it up. You get quite a good range, and you get good clear signals with good Morse code operators coming through. And it certainly began to work very well. But it did add to the weight we carried, and didn't give the poor observer much room to move around in his cockpit.
There was no real period, I take it from what you said earlier, of actually pure experimentation with these new wireless sets. You really did start using them straight away.
Well, we were using them and suggesting, and in a big number of cases, making improvements ourselves and board the ship because we're some very good mechanics. That, are you on again? That was sort of the point that Murray Souter said, the handiness of the Navy is just DIYBS, right? Nowadays they say do it yourself. In those days it was DIYBS, which means do it your bloody self.
I believe also about this time there were some new developments in armament. Could you describe those?
Oh, yes. Just about now the most useful addition to the armament were machine guns. Because I remember Major Holt very well, an RFC chap, came to Montrose when they were taking over from me. I got rather friendly with him, and he had just become rather distinguished in the RFC, being the first pilot to bring down a German plane, somewhere near the English Channel, on the French side, of course, and flying a Martinside single-seater. Well, they didn't have machine guns then, but he got very close to him underneath, so he drew his pistols, a six-shooter, and pinted it up and shot him very neatly and brought him down. But that was, as I say, that would be in September or so, 1915, when Holt did that. So I say the machine guns were not, even in France, I don't think they were part of the equipment. They certainly weren't part of ours. The very good reason that we had nothing to mount them on. You get a chap and observer standing up in the cockpit with a sort of loose-mounted hip, carrying a machine gun at his hip. God knows what he'll shoot away, probably his own tail, which you need when you're flying a plane. And just about then, RNAS warrant officer called Scarf came out with the Scarf ring. A bit most ingenious mounting for the machine gun in the observer's cockpit, which enabled you to swing the machine gun round to any angle you like, cock it up to any angle you like, downwards, just like the ancestor of the present-day gun turret, or the fairly recent gun turret. And so we, by the end of 1915, I should think, we had, or early 16, we had Lewis guns. The observer had Lewis guns, so we at least had some real armament, which was quite useful.
Good. Were there any dangers or difficulties with this new gun mounting and the use of machine guns in these early stages?
I can remember one rather dicey occasion when we were doing some target practice. We used to practice the machine gun at hot air balloons. They were put up. You flew more or less alongside them, and your gunner let fly and shot them down. I mean, it was very good practice. And this particular occasion, I think he was getting, I don't know why he swung his gun forward, but he got a bit excited. He must have swung his gun a bit too far ahead. But I suddenly saw a few pieces flying out the extreme end of my starboard wing. So I shouted to him to chuck it, and he did. So I brought her down very gently on the first or fourth, just in case. And he was a bit indignant about terminating the flight rather early. And in fact, I was very nearly ticked off when we got back to the ship, and after the captain had examined the wingtip, I think he changed his ideas because the one of the very vital interplane struts was virtually shot away. Fortunately, it was a steel tube, but there was a hole through it taking about 7/8 of the metal away, and the main spar had two shots clean through it, so that the very slightest strong gust of wind would have taken the starboard end of my main planes off quite easily, and it would have been just too bad. So that was one of the times when swinging a machine gun carelessly can lead to a bit of anxiety.
Was this due to his inexperience, do you think, or was there a possibility that this kind of thing could happen at any time if you weren't paying
attention? Just a matter of, I think, probably got a bit excited, or standing up high in a cockpit, open cockpit like that, possibly got caught. A bit of a gust of wind shook him, and he may have rocked on his feet or something, but the fact remains he just swung the gun a bit too far to his left, and that was all, with his fingers still on the trigger.
Now, about this time, when you came into much closer association with the regular Navy...
We were regular also.
Okay.
You mean with the Seagull?
About this time, when you came into closer association with the fleet than you had heretofore, could you describe for me the kind of impression which the attitudes of the Navy at sea to the air service were? How did they react to you professionally?
Well, from the purely private and case of visiting ship to ship, there couldn't have been better relations, very good friends. But professionally, at that time, we were in sort of slightly in different worlds. Your seagoing naval officer didn't know the front end from the back end of an aircraft, but we did know the sharp end from the blunt end of a ship. We at least were reasonably au fait with his side of the job, but he hadn't really a clue about the handling limitations and general use of the aircraft, and it took a very long time to get the average chap to realize what we could do and what we couldn't do.
The problem at the time wasn't it, that the regular Navy had great difficulty in deciding what use to it airplanes and seaplanes could be?
I think so. The trouble was that this didn't apply to David Beatty, who was superb. He obviously consulted his captain and other people like that. I mean, you knew what you were doing with him, but it is quite obvious there were some top brass admirals and people who, accidentally or not, I don't know, they would order aircraft out in those utterly impossible conditions when no aircraft could possibly have taken off or functioned, and then would turn around and say, aircraft are no bloody use. A battleship could go out in this, or something of that sort.
Can you remember any concrete examples of this in which you personally were involved that demonstrated this lack of knowledge?
Yes, not till later on, but...
Well, never mind, bring it in now as it's in context.
I forget the date now. I remember one, the best example I think I can remember was probably early 1916. We were over the other side. It was some kind of joint exercise that battle cruisers as such were not involved, so David Beatty wasn't in charge. I think it was a light cruiser force or somewhere from down the coast a bit, but anyway, there weren't ships we knew, and another aircraft carrier, the Vindex. We went right over to the coast of Schleswig-Holstein, which was then part of Germany. an idea of bombing the Zeppelin sheds there, Tondon. It was quite a good idea, because the Zeps would probably be at home in the sheds, and if you can bomb a Zeppelin shed, he's full of hydrogen. He goes well and truly up in the light. And the idea was to bomb them both one or two short seaplanes, but mainly with the Schneider Cup, which were purely fighter escort planes. But at the same time, they had put fairly heavy bombs on. That was the pity. We could carry them all right, but it was this question of takeoff to lift these, I think it was 212 pounders they'd lumbered us with, which were quite good bombs for dropping into an aircraft shed. But except under very favourable conditions, to take a Schneider Cup seaplane, which is was a very fast, small fighter plane, off the water with that, unless you'd just a very small ripple of sea, was completely hopeless. She either sank by the tail before you could even get going because of the weight, or if you really got going, she was very apt to turn ass over tip and exit the plane and throttle the pilot. It was all a matter of what the conditions were like. Anything in the nature of a big groundswell was completely hopeless. So we got right over to the point off the coast, and we hadn't been spotted, and everything seemed to be going quite well according to plan. We were just beginning to hoist the Schneider Cup sopwith out when somebody put up an alarm about submarine sighted somewhere, so the Admiral immediately ordered his destroyers to circle the flotilla. And naturally, thinking of his own ships, he's got to protect his ships against submarine attack. So about a dozen powerful destroyers began to circle the flotilla, making a circle of about perhaps 2 miles in diameter or something like that, and going like the hammers and looking marvellous, making a cross swell, which no small or large seaplane had the hope of a celluloid cat in hell of taking off. Well, we did our best. One chap, Openshaw, actually bounced off the top of a wave and made it.